Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends. Even better, you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. If you're like me, then you have different family members who have different ailments, and I've recommended Mood to all of them. I legitimately, before recording this, I told my mom about Mood, and she's going to make her first order. Because they have gummies for all sorts of things, for pain relief, for sleeping, for just improving your mood. Their gummies are specially blended and each one feels different. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out in 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I wake up feeling amazing. And each gummy is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. This holiday season, comfort is slowing down and finding calm amidst the chaos. As the holidays fill up with gatherings, travel, and to-do lists, Avocado Green Mattress helps you create a space that's calm, cozy, and restorative. Avocado products transform your home into a peaceful, grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. But more importantly, they offer unmatched comfort. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, Avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. And every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and the quality you're bringing into your home. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado. Dream of better. The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S., so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Here are a few things that I'm getting. Unlock the Beer Escape Room. It's a cute little cage that you could put a six-pack of beer in, and then you have to do an escape room to get the code to open the cage. I am absolutely getting this for my brother-in-law because this is in his wheelhouse in every way. The DIY Root Beer Science Kit I'm getting for my 8-year-old because he has recently discovered root beer and he likes learning. So this is going to be a really fun project for the both of us. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ATTWG. That's uncommongoods.com/ATTWG for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Nineteen-year-old Sage Smith was on the precipice of starting a new life. Just a few weeks away from her 20th birthday, the Charlottesville, Virginia teen had moved out on her own, started taking classes, and was seeing a new guy. She had also just come out to her family as transgendered. Sage's life was full of promise and big changes. On November 20th, 2012, Sage was going to meet the new guy she was seeing before going back to her family's home for Thanksgiving. But Sage never made it home the next day. And what seemed like a straightforward yet tragic case of violence has turned into an 8-year-long mystery that has resulted in 2 missing persons reports. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Sage Smith. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us for this story, which is semi-local to us. Before we get started on Sage's case, though, I'd like to talk about some related issues in telling her story. We strive to be inclusive and sensitive on this show, but, you know, we're human, and like everyone else, we make mistakes sometimes. Sage's story is a little tricky because she publicly came out as transgendered not too long before her disappearance, like literally 2 weeks. She wrote something on Facebook, you know, about, you know, I'm a girl now, like that's how I want you to refer to me. But since it had just happened, a lot of people in her life hadn't like wrapped their heads around it.
Okay, yet. So there's probably going to be a lot of people referring to her as him.
Yeah. So there's okay. A lot of that. So when you read articles or watch interviews with her friends and family, some people refer to her as Sage and use she pronouns. Some refer to her as Sage but use he pronouns.
Oh, so Sage was his name before?
No. Sage is her name. So okay. That's the name we're using. But because, and yet others will refer to her as Deshaud, which is her birth name, and okay. use he pronouns. And one of her best friends and roommates, Shakira Washington, had known Sage since they were in middle school. She is also trans and said that Sage used both names and pronouns kind of interchangeably. So the way Shakira describes it, Sage was more gender fluid.
Okay.
Interestingly, in the episode of Disappeared on this case, Shakira refers to Sage as he. But it does seem as though right before she disappeared, like I said, Sage did want to go by that name and be referred to as she. So that's what we're going to do on this episode.
Okay.
So I just wanted to like clear that up because it is, if you ever do read about this case, especially because this all started in 2012 and the way people refer to her have evolved over time. And a lot of the early coverage was very, 2012, I guess I should say, because they basically describe Sage as a man who dressed in women's clothing sometimes.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's ignorance.
Yeah. But, yeah. You know. And so Charlottesville Police, which is the agency in charge of this case, you know, they've made various statements because they did a lot of misgendering. And so they recently came out and said like, hey, you know, we will refer to her as she and Sage, but we still have to talk about the gender she was assigned at birth at times, because honestly, they're expecting to find a body.
Yeah.
And right. So, you know,
Yeah.
So that's kind of, I just wanted to like really talk about that before we got into this whole thing, just, you know, to clear up any confusion and let everybody know what we're doing and how we are trying to refer to everyone in the story, because it's not just Sage, everyone in the story properly as much as possible. Now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's talk about Sage. Sage Smith was born in Charlottesville, Virginia on December 13th, 1992 to Latasha Dennis and Dean Smith. Charlottesville, located in central Virginia, is home to the University of Virginia. It's definitely a college town, and the residents there are mostly white. While there are certainly progressive pockets in the area, it's also a town that's absolutely obsessed with Thomas Jefferson. You know, and his stance on race isn't exactly the best.
Sure. I mean, that's putting it lightly.
Yeah. And listeners may also recall that it was the site of the 2017 Richard Spencer-led neo-Nazi flare-up where they all danced around in khaki pants with their tiki torches.
I mean, look, you can't get away from the fact that it's in Southern Virginia.
More central Virginia, well, but yeah,
I mean, okay. You are correct. Although in my mind, if you're not in Northern Virginia, you're Southern Virginia.
I know.
This whole area is South to me.
Yeah, for sure.
So even where we live, Northern Virginia, it's still South to me.
Well, yeah. And oh God, man, we're in Northern Virginia, but we are showing our asses. Loudoun County,
God,
making the national news again for people being absolutely insane. Interestingly,
for people being racist
and anti-trans, because the big school board flare-up was about transgendered issues and how a teacher got suspended for refusing to call a student by her correct pronouns. And yeah, they're saying it's a freedom of speech issue, which it's not. But anyway, I don't want to get off on that. But my point is that
can we just say this real quick? Mm-hmm. The thing that I don't understand about all of this anti-trans stuff is mm-hmm. like, who cares? It doesn't affect you, the person saying he or she. So who cares?
Yeah.
Like, how hard is it to just refer to somebody by how they want to be referred to? It's just mind-blowing to me. Like, there's a lot of stuff about this that I'm very ignorant on, but, like, I don't care.
Yeah.
If you want to be called a woman or a man, whatever. It doesn't affect me.
Right. It doesn't. People should try what I do, which is just be extremely self-absorbed, and then none of it matters. But yeah, and you know, I think it is tough because it really goes back to Sage's story here. And, you know, because a lot of Sage's story and her family, it's about accepting her and, you know, and everything. And it's about violence that trans people often face. And there is some of that, you know, in this story, of course. And it's just try to be better. Like, it's just, you're right. It just doesn't, just who cares? Like, do your best.
You.
And if you mess up, say you're sorry. Like, you know, because I think people get so like, well, how am I supposed to know? And I can't say anything. And it's da, 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 da. And, you know, we actually accidentally misgendered somebody on this show a few weeks ago. So in our Ralph G. Marie case, Lee Morrigan, who is the activist who is arrested, they refer to themselves as they, them.
Right.
And we accidentally
said up.
He a few times. And we did that because before I knew anything about Lee Morrigan, I had just come across their name in articles. And to me, that name just stuck in my head as a male name.
Right.
And so because of that, I just kept saying he. And I actually spoke with Lee and I was like, I owe you a huge apology. I am so sorry. I did not mean to. And what they said to me is they said, listen, like, I get misgendered on purpose a lot and that sucks, you know, because people do it just to be shitty.
Just to be assholes.
But, and they said, I look at the intent behind it. You know, I get it. Like, sometimes people make mistakes. If you make mistakes, it's okay. And so they were very cool about it. And, you know, but I did want to find a way to also publicly apologize to them because like, I hate that we did that. But I mean, again, it was just really, it was a complete, you know, mistake on our part and we didn't mean anything by it. But anyway, yeah, Charlottesville, Virginia has a lot of issues with race because like I said, it's mostly white and, you know, you've got the college, which is mostly white, but then the staff at the college, like in the cafeterias and, you know, places like that are mostly people of color. And so you've still got this whole weird class distinction, race, you know, distinction in the town. There's like one part of Charlottesville where like most of the black people live, basically. So Sage was not only growing up black in this town, but she was also growing up poor and, you know, she was from a troubled family. Sage's parents separated when she was small and Sage eventually went to go live with her grandmother, who is known as Miss Cookie.
Oh, that's adorable.
She is adorable, by the way. And she's called Miss Cookie because she's so sweet.
Oh, I thought maybe she was like the grandma that always had cookies.
I mean, maybe that too. But yeah, I mean, and honestly, if there is a Disappeared episode on this case, and it is worth watching like solely for Miss Cookie. She's amazing. But when Sage was 12, they moved from an affordable housing complex to a home in the Fifeville neighborhood in Charlottesville, which is where Sage and Shakira met. Shakira was that friend that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
According to Emma Eisenberg's article in Splinter, Shakira lived two doors down from Sage. They were both in middle school, and Shakira was actually already out as transgendered and was asking her teachers to use female pronouns.
This was in middle school, you said?
In middle school, yeah.
Wow, that's
in Charlottesville.
That's brave.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Good for her.
I know. But and this gave Sage the courage to come out to his grandma as gay. So Sage, you know, it was kind of one step at a time, right?
Well,
and,
sure. Yeah.
And so Sage was not going by Sage at the time. She was not going by female pronouns at the time at all. Her first step was to come out as gay. And Miss Cookie is so adorable when she talks about Sage. And you can really, it's really interesting when you watch all of Sage's family members. Like, Miss Cookie is the one who, like, you really feel gets it. Gets who she was, like, on a very deep level, and, like, always understood. So when Sage told her that, you know, they were gay in middle school, she was just like, oh, honey, you're not telling me anything I don't already know. Like, we were waiting.
Yeah, that's probably, you know, the best response.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So for many years, Sage was living her life as a gay male, but that didn't go over well with everyone in her family.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. Sage's father, Dean, had spent a good chunk of Sage's childhood in prison for drug offenses, so he wasn't really around much. Initially, when Sage came out as gay, like, he could not handle it. He told Sage not to talk to him and that he just wasn't going to accept. He said, don't call my cell phone. Like, you know, we're done.
That's really unfortunate.
Yeah. But Dean was on that episode of Disappeared, and he said that it was actually his youngest son. So Sage was his oldest child, and it was his youngest son who basically made him realize what an ass he was being. Because his son was like, what are you doing? Like, you've always told us to, like, be happy with ourselves and, like, with who we are. And, like, you're being a dick. And so Dean was like, yeah, I kind of am. And so it took him a little while, but he really came around, and, you know, he and Sage repaired their relationship, and things, you know, were good between them. And it sounds like as Sage reached her teenage years, she started dressing in women's clothing, but wasn't officially out as transgendered. And she would really kind of go back and forth. And, like, everybody says that, you know, like, she would dress up, you know, in women's clothing, but, like, but then wear a suit. The way Miss Cookie put it, she said, she's like, Sage didn't care. She just always wanted to look fly. But after she graduated high school, it sounds like she really started to want to transition in earnest. Shakira had been starting to take hormones, and so Sage had been talking to her about that and, you know, wanted to start that herself. At some point, though, during her childhood, Miss Cookie gave Sage back to her mother, Latasha, but Latasha was deemed unfit, so Sage actually ended up in foster care for a time, I think during high school. Mm. Yeah, the timeline of that is a little unclear, but the reason why I think it was, you know, toward the end of her high school career, because as Sage aged out of the system, she received money to get an apartment.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So she got the apartment, and she had Shakira and another friend, Aubrey Carson, move in with her. Sage had decided that she wanted to study cosmetology and become a hairdresser, and she was also taking classes to help reach that goal. But that wasn't the only thing she was doing. According to that Splinter article, Sage and her friends partied and had hookups, just like, you know, 19-year-olds.
Like, yeah.
You know, they're out on their own for the first time, but apparently some of these hookups were for money. In addition to that, they would have parties that would cater to men on the down low, which is men who are interested in having homosexual encounters but weren't publicly out. They also apparently hooked up with a solid chunk of married men. Mm. Sage and her friends were aware of possible dangers when it came to hookups like this, and she and Shakira would let the other know where they were, and they would, like, text each other to check up and, you know, make sure everyone was okay. Shakira actually told a story about when she hooked up with a married UVA professor.
Whoa.
And yeah. And, like, Sage was literally in the bushes outside to, like, make sure she was okay.
Yikes.
Yeah. But that wasn't enough to completely eliminate the danger that they faced. And some of it was simply for existing. Sage and her friends would get harassed on the street. They would get called names for being trans. Another time, a friend told her that she needed to watch her back because Sage had apparently told a guy's wife that she had hooked up with him, and that guy was very angry.
Yeah, that's not a great position to be in.
Yeah. The night before her disappearance, they were having a party at the apartment for Shakira's birthday when some woman came busting in trying to start a fight with another one of their friends over a guy. The whole thing became a huge fight that went out into the street, and Sage started fighting a man named Jamal Smith. Jamal then called the police, saying that Sage damaged his car. The cops came and no one was arrested, but Shakira says that Sage was pissed at her for not having her back in the fight, basically. This was Shakira's birthday and everyone was really upset after all of this. So she actually got a ride early the next morning and went back home for Thanksgiving earlier than she was supposed to, just to kind of get out. When Sage woke up on the morning of November 20th, everything seemed okay with her, though. She called her dad. They talked on the phone for a while, and she asked him for money to get her hair braided. That evening, her other roommate, Aubrey, said that Sage woke them up from a nap to tell them that she was going to meet a guy. And this was around at 5:30, somewhere around there. And quick side note, Aubrey is another one who I'm going to try really hard not to misgender. Aubrey seems as though they present as a woman, but most of what I've seen in this case uses male pronouns when referring to Aubrey. But then I read one story where they used female pronouns, so I'm just going to try to stick with they as much as possible. Anyway, Aubrey went back to sleep on the couch, but tried calling Sage when they woke back up around 8 p.m. But the call went straight to voicemail, which was unusual. Even more unusual was the fact that Sage never came home that night and continued to not answer her phone. The next morning around 9, Aubrey called Shakira to see if she had heard from Sage. When she said she hadn't, the pair agreed that they needed to call Miss Cookie. She also hadn't heard from Sage, so she told Aubrey to immediately call the police. Now, this is now the day before Thanksgiving. This is Wednesday, and Sage had plans to be with her family for the holiday, and she wasn't just the type to ditch something like that and go incommunicado. I mean, Sage was somebody that you could always get in touch with. She always had her phone on her, and, you know, Shakira's she would charge her phone anywhere, you know, any spare outlet she could find if they were out or whatever. So Aubrey called the Charlottesville police like Miss Cookie asked them to, but says that they didn't seem super interested in the fact that no one had heard from Sage. They took Sage's basic information, asked for a photo, but they didn't start investigating until the next day, which was Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, you know, we've run into this problem before.
19-year-old college town, right before the holiday.
Yeah, hindsight being 20/20, I'm sure that everybody's going to judge the police on that. But, you know, the reality is just what you said. She's an adult, you know, it's right before a holiday. It's a college town. Is it worth jumping full into an investigation at that point?
Right. And there'll be plenty of other reasons for us to judge the police in this story. So we don't really need to worry about it for this. So when they did start the investigation, 6 police officers conducted what they termed a grid search of the main corridor, which for those of you who have been to Charlottesville is where the pedestrian mall is. And it's basically where everything is in Charlottesville. So if you were going to go out, that's kind of where you would go. They looked all over and went to different businesses on the mall to see if any of them had surveillance cameras. But it was 2012, and Charlottesville isn't exactly a crime-ridden city, especially not on this pedestrian mall.
Yeah.
So apparently only 3 of the businesses actually had cameras, and none of them caught anything that was worthwhile. But police did find an eyewitness who had seen Sage that night, and it happened to be her own stepsister.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because it's just Charlottesville, again, it's not a large place, and that pedestrian mall is where everybody would be. And that area of Charlottesville is also near the bus station and the train station. So her stepsister was actually going to get on the bus, and that's when she ran into Sage. So Sage's stepsister, Kiara Morgan, was on her way to catch the bus around 6:30 p.m. on November 20th. So this is about an hour after Sage left the apartment, give or take. She ran into Sage, who was alone. The pair chatted a little bit, and Sage told her that she was meeting a guy. And Sage actually got a phone call from the guy while she was there with Kiara. And so Kiara heard, you know, her half of the conversation. And so from what she gathered, Sage was actually late meeting him. And so Sage said that she would be there in 5 minutes. They were supposed to meet at the nearby Amtrak station. Sage said her goodbyes to Kiara, and Sage walked westbound on Main Street at around 6:40 p.m. So while police were investigating, they didn't seem to be treating Sage's disappearance with the amount of urgency that her family felt was necessary. So they started their own parallel investigation.
Okay. The family did.
The family.
Okay.
They were able to guess Sage's passwords. They were able to log on to her cell phone account.
Mm.
Yeah. And they got her records. So they could see everyone who she had been calling and texting and vice versa. They saw one number that kept on popping up on the 20th, and it was an out-of-state area code. Nobody knew who it was. And it was that the last call that Sage received. So the family called it. And called and called and called, but no one answered. Dean, you know, on that episode of Disappeared, he was like, we called that number a million times and nobody ever answered. But Dean, in this, I love this. He was like, all right, well, that's not going to stop me. So now by this time, again, this is a few days after Sage's disappearance. So by this time, the posts on Facebook have started happening and, you know, people are aware that Sage is missing. So Dean went on Facebook and posted the number.
Oh.
Yeah. And he said, like, does anyone know who this number is? This is the last person my child talked to.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Well, it went well because, like, I mean, it went well for him. I mean, because he did find out. And Dean didn't care. He already did not like the Charlottesville police. He had had run-ins with them, didn't trust them, didn't think they were going to do a good job on this investigation. So he was just keeping the secret because, like, he didn't tell him. He knew they were going to tell him not to do it.
Sure.
And he didn't want to. So he just did it. And a person named Yami Ortiz messaged Dean and said that they knew who the number belonged to.
Hmm.
It was a man named Eric McFadden. Eric was 22 years old and had recently moved to Charlottesville. He was working at the local Sherwin-Williams paint store, but had plans to take classes in the spring. He had apparently done a year or two of college up in Pennsylvania, I believe, and then left for whatever reason and moved down to Charlottesville.
Why is it always going to come back to my home state?
It's always Pennsylvania.
Pennsyltucky.
And he was the man that Sage was supposed to meet on the night of November 20th. The pair had been seeing each other for a little while, and Yami apparently knew both of them. Yami told Dean that Eric randomly messaged them on November 21st, the day after Sage was last seen, and asked them to delete his contact information from their phone. Yeah, so Yami...
Suspicious much?
Yeah, so it was interesting. So it was the day after Sage disappeared, so I think Yami might have known that Sage was gone, but had no idea at that point that Sage was supposed to meet Eric or anything like that. Right. So, like, had no idea that Eric was connected to or possibly connected to Sage's disappearance at all.
You say that that they had been seeing each other.
Yeah.
So this is not in connection with her being a sex worker, or is it? Or do we not know?
Well, we don't know definitively. It could be.
It could have been an irregular hookup.
Yes.
Okay.
And it was a regular hookup regardless. I just don't know.
Yeah. And we not saying that this should matter much as far as the investigation goes, but we don't know if Charlottesville PD knows that angle about the sex work.
Right. At this point, they do not.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't find that out until a little bit later.
I'm not saying that like excuses them for not doing further investigation, but it might, that has a kind of a different angle as far as the police investigation would go.
Yeah. Yeah. So they don't know that at all at this point. Dami, like I said, knew Sage was missing, knew that Eric had been seeing her, whatever, but again, didn't connect those two things at all. But then obviously when Dean posted the number and said, this is the person who my child last spoke with.
And after getting that, they delete my contact.
Well, yeah, then after that, like, he was like, oh, yeah, it's kind of weird that weird, he. Yeah. So that's when he's like, okay, that's strange. And so he told Dean, you know, what was up. So according, and I think all of this came from Yami, apparently Eric and Sage had met online, more than likely through one of Sage's casual encounters ads that she posted on Craigslist. So that was apparently something that Sage would do relatively often.
Fucking Craigslist.
Yeah. Casual Encounters was a section on Craigslist that doesn't exist anymore. But at the time, people could anonymously post various hookup requests. And so that's the thing, because a lot of people would just do, like I said, just hookup requests, whatever. But I think part of the reason why it got shut down was because there was sex work happening on there as well.
Yeah, and there was quite a few cases that where mm-hmm. sex work resulted in murder.
Yeah,
which I think ultimately is what led to that being shut down.
Right, and so that's why the whole the nature of their relationship and whether or
it
not
was a little unclear.
Yeah. So it could have just been like two people, you know, looking to hang out, looking to do whatever, or there could have been
some sort of money
monetary
exchange.
Agreement. Yeah. And there was money exchange, and we'll get to that too, but for different reasons, perhaps. Eric wanted to keep his dalliances with Sage anonymous, because like many of her other partners, Eric presented as straight. In fact, he even lived with his girlfriend, a woman named Esther. And Esther was not aware of Sage or anyone else that Eric may have been having relationships with. While Dean is getting all this information, officers are still searching for Sage, and they're starting to suspect foul play. They were looking in empty lots, dumpsters, parks, you know, places like that. But they weren't getting anywhere. But then on November 24th, the name Eric McFadden entered their investigation, but from a different source, Eric's girlfriend, Esther. Esther had left town for Thanksgiving, but couldn't get a hold of her boyfriend. And this went on for several days, and so she finally decided to call police and ask them to go to her apartment to do a welfare check. She was afraid that something had happened to Eric and he was inside. Now, at this point, police are just performing this welfare check on a random individual.
Unrelated. Yeah.
Yeah. So no clue as to any possible connection to Sage's case. So they went over, you know, knocked on the door, found no one was there, like left. But later that same day, Yanni Ortiz went to police and made the connection for them. He told them about Dean's post, the phone number, the relationship, all of it. So they call the Sherwin-Williams store and realize that Eric hasn't shown up to work in the past 3 days.
Mm.
Yeah. So now they're looking like they have a suspect, and they're making the connection between the fact that his girlfriend hasn't heard from him and, you know, they had just done this welfare check and all that. So police started circulating his name and photo as a person possibly connected to Sage's disappearance.
Yeah.
They also returned to the apartment he shared with Esther and did a proper search. This time, they were looking for signs that Sage had been there. So they were looking for any possible like blood, DNA, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
During the search, they seized Eric's computer and found a CVS receipt dated November 22nd, which was after Esther had left town and 2 days after Sage's disappearance. So the police don't know exactly how to take this, right? Because this was 2 days after Sage disappeared and it couldn't have been Esther's. So they went to that CVS and were able to see surveillance video and confirm that it was actually Eric who went in and made the purchase. So he was at the CVS nearby on the night of November 22nd.
Do we know what he purchased?
No, I don't think it was anything
relevant.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he was in town 2 full days after Sage was last seen, but then he apparently took off. So the question is, did he skip town because he did something to Sage, or did he skip town because The next day, the 23rd, is when Dean put his number up on Facebook and he was outed.
Right. Yeah. And that's tough to say because, yeah. I mean, both are strong possibilities.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Did he skip town innocently, mm-hmm. quote unquote innocently, because right. he was outed on Facebook? Or was there something nefarious?
Exactly. So police at this point have no idea.
Yeah.
On November 25th, Eric contacted Esther. He tells her he's in D.C., which for those of you who are unfamiliar with this area, it's about 2.5 hours away from Charlottesville, give or take, maybe three. So he calls Esther, tells her where he is, and asks her for money. Now, I find this interesting. One, because like, holy shit, the balls on this guy.
Right? Yeah.
Like, but two, because of the theory that he just left town because he was publicly outed. If he was so concerned about being outed that he would just skip town, would he really call his girlfriend, whom he had just publicly betrayed, and ask her for money?
I mean, I guess if you don't have any other option.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, nothing men do like ever surprise me anymore, but like, it just seems a little extra. I don't know if she gave him money, but she did give him the contact information for the detectives working Sage's case.
Hey, you need to clear your name.
If, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she's like, you should probably give these guys a call. They kind of want to talk to you. And so on November 27th, he did. On that call, he tells investigators that now he's in New York City. But, you know, not for any suspicious reasons. He's just always wanted to see the Big Apple.
Just conveniently happens to be around the time that, you know, the person he was hooking up with goes missing.
Yes. He also tells them that he was supposed to meet Sage on the night of the 20th, but she never showed. And so police are like, all right, cool, cool, cool. Why don't you come back to Charlottesville and we'll chat about this more in person?
Yeah, I think we need to have a little face-to-face talk.
Yeah. And Eric immediately hung up on them.
Well, increasing suspicious behavior.
Yeah. But later, Esther apparently called the detectives back and said that Eric would come back into town. So I guess she talked to him after this and like convinced him to come back. But apparently right before he was due to board the bus back to Charlottesville, he emailed Esther and told her that he had changed his mind.
Oh boy.
During all of this, police continued to investigate Eric. They find out that his garbage got delivered to a dump about 60 miles away in Henrico County, Virginia. And, you know, during this time, like in the first couple weeks of this investigation, they even went to the dump, you know, just looking for anything related to Sage, but didn't find anything. In early December, Esther returned to the police station and told them that she had received another email from Eric. And I should mention that these emails she's receiving from him aren't from his normal account. Like, he keeps on creating different burner accounts.
Oh. Look, if this guy is innocent, he's just going about this all the wrong way.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Good Lord, you're just like painting a target on yourself at this point.
Yeah, yeah. In this email, he tells her an entirely different version of events from November 20th. He said that he did actually meet up with Sage and that they were walking together by the Amtrak station when basically like they got jumped. I don't know. Like they, like apparently a group of people approached them and seemed like they were angry. And Eric said that he just left Sage behind before anything bad could happen, and he didn't know what happened after that.
How noble of him.
I know, right?
If that story is true, yeah. Which I'm going to call bullshit on.
Of course.
Like, wow.
Yeah.
You're just a fucking stand-up guy.
Yeah.
Aren't you? That's great.
He also, in this email, apologized to Esther for hurting her and said that he was heading to the Midwest. And so, you know what this actually reminds me of?
Hmm.
So, and apparently in this email too, he said something to the effect of like, Sage had a lot of enemies, right? So this kind of reminds me of that piece of shit, Chris Watts.
Yeah.
Who keeps on changing the story about what happened and keeps on trying to place the blame on the victim.
Oh yeah. Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's, I got some real like Chris Watts vibes from this whole story. But if the story is true, which is obviously extremely unlikely, the fact that it's 180 degrees different from when he told police is making them want to talk to Eric even more. Mm-hmm. While they couldn't get that to happen, they were able to obtain warrants to search his bank account, computer, social media, things like that. According to that episode of Disappeared, while the email did help the police uncover more details about Eric and Sage's relationship, it actually made them less convinced that he had anything to do with her disappearance.
That's interesting.
I think it's very interesting. Oh, and I should mention, too, that in one of the emails, before we get into this, in one of the emails, and because we did mention money being exchanged, Eric tells Esther that Sage was blackmailing him to keep the relationship quiet.
Okay.
And that he said he had given Sage money and that was why. So I think the question is Eric telling the truth about Sage blackmailing him, or was he giving Sage money because that was their agreement?
I mean, I think it's more likely that it was the agreement.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem as though Sage was running into a lack of suitors.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that would seem like a big jump. Because at this point, we haven't heard anything about her blackmailing anybody else to mm-hmm. keep the relationships secret.
Yeah.
And didn't she like come out or, you know, just say to...
He told a married man's wife
that like, okay, so I mean, like, that doesn't seem like a blackmail situation.
Or
unless the
maybe she had tried to blackmail him and the married man was like, no.
Yeah.
And then she told his wife.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, maybe. I really don't know. I can't speculate. But so I'm guessing that, you know, he knew that there was going to be some sort of money trail. And so that was his explanation that he was giving for that.
Okay.
Regardless, money was exchanged between the two. Back to why his electronic footprints made police less convinced that he was involved with Sage's disappearance. Apparently, the night of November 20th, which is the night she went missing, Eric was up and periodically using his phone and computer until something like 3 a.m. And it was all very normal usage, not like searches on how to hide a body or anything like that. Plus, there's the fact that police haven't discovered any sort of crime scene, either in Sage's apartment, Eric's apartment, or anywhere in between.
Right.
And the important thing to note about Eric is he couldn't drive. And it's not just that he didn't own a car or have a license. He actually had never learned how to drive. Like, he was taking lessons from a friend at the time. So if he had done something to Sage, police were wondering how he could have disposed of the body in such an efficient manner.
Right.
So while they're doing all of this, you know, electronic investigation, they're still performing searches. There was the landfill search that I mentioned earlier, and they brought cadaver dogs to search the area around Main Street, as well as the railroad tracks and the area around Eric's apartment. Apparently, one of the dogs gave a slight indication that they had picked up Sage's scent, but it didn't really go anywhere. They also searched a nearby pond, but found nothing. While it does seem like the police were taking this seriously and actually, you know, performing an investigation, Sage's family was not happy with how things were progressing. Apparently, they would have to leave several messages with police before they were given any updates. And in December, they requested a meeting with the chief of police, and that meeting took 9 months to actually happen.
Wow.
Yeah. But then in February of 2013, a new eyewitness came forward and she muddied the waters even more for investigators. This woman, Monica Williams, contacted police to say that she had seen Sage on November 20th at Wild Wings Cafe, which is a cafe that was actually connected to the Amtrak station.
Okay.
Monica was going there to pick up a to-go order and saw Sage sitting at the bar alone. They chatted for a minute or two, and then Monica got her food and left. This sighting was at 7 p.m., a solid 20 minutes after her stepsister had seen her walking away. So this, you know, gives the timeline an extra like 20 minutes or so.
Yeah.
When I say that this sighting muddied the waters, investigators took it to mean that it could actually clear Eric McFadden. According to Kiera, Sage said she would meet Eric in 5 minutes. This sighting was after that, so police say that she could have met him and then gone to the cafe afterwards, meaning she saw Eric and was fine, so something happened to her later.
I mean, it could, but what was Eric's version of events as far as the timeline goes?
Well, I'm not sure if he gave a time when he emailed Esther, like the story about actually seeing Sage.
Yeah.
Because his timeline of events to police was that he never saw her.
Right.
So I'm not sure what his exact timeline is. But to me, it's just as likely, if not likelier, that she was sitting there waiting for Eric. According to Sage's phone records, it seems like Eric and Sage were supposed to meet at 6. He texted her at 6:08, asking where she was, then again at 6:12. So I should mention real quick that, you know, when Sage's family was able to guess her password and get into her account, they were able to see the phone numbers, but not the actual texts. Police later were able to get the full records and actually see all of the text messages themselves.
Right. Yeah. The content you need a warrant for.
Exactly. So they did get that warrant and then were later able to find the content. So that's where we're getting this information from. So he texts her at 6:08 asking where she was, and then again at 6:12. Between 6:18 and 6:37, he texted her several more times, but during that time period, she was actually talking on the phone with someone else, so she may not have gotten those texts as they came through. At 6:27, he sent her a text saying that she'd stood him up. Kiera saw Sage at 6:35, and that's when Sage spoke to Eric on the phone, so that's when that last phone call was.
And we're assuming this is all confirmed by the police investigation.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. So when Sage spoke to him, Kiera heard her say that she was going to be there in 5 minutes. Sage walked off to meet him, and that was around 6:40. But, you know, maybe Eric was annoyed and had already left where they were going to be meeting. So, you know, she gets to the cafe and then waits however long for him to get there. And maybe he still hasn't arrived by 7, which is only 20 minutes later. And that's why Monica saw her there alone. But for whatever reason, this 7 p.m. sighting was enough for police to announce publicly that Eric was no longer a person of interest in Sage's case.
So I'm wondering if maybe during a search of his computer and phone records, they found something that alibied him elsewhere. Just, I don't know why they wouldn't put that out.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem like it.
When did Monica, that was her name?
Oh, yeah, the witness?
Yeah, when did she come out and say this?
This was several months later, so this was February of 2013.
Yeah, I mean...
And I should say that police did go back to, you know, Wild Wings Cafe to ask the people who worked there and verify.
Yeah.
And they obviously didn't have surveillance 3 months later or anything like that, if they even had it at all. Like the employees there, they're like, yeah, we kind of remember like trans people being there that night, but like we can't say for sure if it was Sage, you know, that kind of a thing. Yeah. So to me, and we'll get into Sage's family's reaction to this whole announcement, which is not positive, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, I mean, police don't really give much of a reason for this. And even in the disappeared episode, you know, the detective was saying like, yeah, we just kept on thinking like he couldn't have done it and he couldn't have disposed of a body.
Okay. The disposal of the body, I will give them that. That is problematic for, as far as the investigation goes. But I just, this doesn't definitively alibi him.
No, it absolutely doesn't.
There's no hard evidence. I'm not discounting Monica's recollection.
Yeah.
Like, this is several months later. How can she be so precise as far as the time goes?
And she just said around 7.
Right. So that does not definitively alibi him.
No. So, because they very easily could have just met up after that.
Yeah. And if there's something else that they have that does definitively alibi him, like maybe a ping on a cell phone tower somewhere else.
So it's actually funny that you mentioned pings because they did look into that. But Charlottesville is such a small town that the cell phone towers are very close together.
Oh, okay. So,
they looked at the pings, but it was like, it was completely useless because it just basically covered like the whole area.
Yeah. And it's also important to note that incoming calls are not pinging incoming calls are not reliable because that goes to it's all outgoing.
Right. Well, I don't know if that was true in 2012. That was certainly true in 1999, 2000.
Oh, you think the technology has changed?
I think it may have.
Oh.
But maybe not. I don't know. But in any case, the cell towers were just too close together. And so the pings in this case, ingoing or outgoing, were not helpful in the investigation.
Right. Well, at any rate, maybe they do have some other evidence that alibis him, but it would make sense.
I'm going to say spoiler alert a little bit.
Okay.
They don't.
Okay. All right. To me, that sighting does not solidly prove that he didn't meet up with her.
Right. And I feel the same way. And so does Sage's family. And so everybody was like, what the hell? Now, the one thing that I was thinking when I first heard about that maybe it could have been a clever ploy to like get him to come back.
Oh, so at this point, they haven't even interviewed him.
No.
Oh, no, no, no.
So I thought, well, maybe like if by making like, oh, no, he's cool. Don't worry about it.
Then
that like maybe
would
it would
back.
Flush him out.
Okay.
But that doesn't seem to be what's they did. I think that would have been good, but yeah, that doesn't seem to be the point. I think they genuinely were like, oh no, I don't think he has anything to do with it. So that is where we're going to leave you this week. I know, another two-parter. And I honestly thought that this was going to be a really quick case to talk about because I was aware of it before I started researching it for this episode. And it did seem pretty straightforward. But once I started digging into it, I found out that there are not only these bigger issues about the investigation itself, but other possible suspects, or at the very least, people that should be talked about a little bit more and typically aren't. So I want to give Sage the time and space that she deserves and tell her story as fully as I'm able to. Next week, we're going to talk about the police investigation over the years and how it compares to those of other missing persons in the Charlottesville area. We're also going to dig down more into Eric McFadden and his role in this investigation after 2012 and after they said that he was no longer a suspect. But before we go, I want to leave you with something that Sage's grandmother, Miss Cookie, said. Quote, "What makes one life more valuable than another? That's how it makes our family feel, that we don't matter." End quote. Sage does matter, though. Her life matters. So we'll tell more of her story next week. There are a lot of people who were in Sage's life and Eric McFadden's life who know something who could help this case. Let's get her name out there more so hopefully we can find some answers. Sage Smith has been missing from Charlottesville, Virginia since November 20th, 2012. She was wearing a black jacket, dark gray sweatpants, and black and gray rain boots. She's around 5'10" and 130 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She was 19 years old when she went missing. She would be 28 today. If you have any information about what happened to Sage Smith, please contact the Charlottesville Police Department at 434-970-3280. You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com. And part two will be available early on our Patreon page. You can go to patreon.com/attwgpod.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at attwgpod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for part two of Sage Smith's story.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.